From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we talk with film director and Milwaukee native John Ridley about NO Studio's first anniversary and its upcoming summit on arts and social justice. Then a photographic exhibition at Milwaukee Public Library's Central Branch explores perception and blindness.
This exhibit's about our shared humanity and our shared fragility. I think we all share both of those sense of qualities in our lives. It's about adaptation, about perception, about understanding.
Plus, a new book about Midwestern folklore looks at the roots and legacy of the region's most infamous legends.
Perhaps the best thing we have as humans is our ability to believe in wonder and to look beyond preconceived notions and really test our own critical thinking skills to believe there might be more out there than we can see and feel and hear every day.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. A year ago, NO Studios opened its doors in the old Pabst Brewery complex. The community workspace is the brainchild of director and screenwriter John Ridley, who won an Oscar for his screenplay 12 Years a Slave. The Milwaukee native wanted to create a place in his hometown for creative collaboration and socializing. NO Studios is now hosting a two-day summit on social justice, which will look at how art can play a part in tackling issues like homelessness, human trafficking, and mass incarceration. The summit will be held at NO Studios on Friday and at Marquette University on Saturday. We reached Ridley at his office in California to find out more, and he explains to Lake Effect's Bonnie North why he thinks art has something to say about activism and social justice.
You know, when we started NO Studios, really one of the things that was very important to us was trying to bring communities together. You know, sometimes situations are so polarized, we think, well, there's nothing that brings us together. And then other times, there are things where we naturally, we just congregate as people and we enjoy ourselves. You know, art is one of those spaces where there's a communal experience, whether literally, if you're in a theater with other people, and sometimes just a bit at a distance. You know, you think about popular TV shows and we may watch them or stream them at home, but the conversations about what's happening on their shows, what we think is going to happen, you know, it dominates the public space. So for us at NO Studios, we certainly wanted throughout the year for people to find commonality through art. But for me personally, one of the things that I've experienced over the years with the kinds of stories that I've told, some of them very difficult, some of them very challenging, some of them very emotional, but at the same time, because of the impact of the stories, they really rallied people around causes. Sometimes it's just about connectivity and seeing ourselves in other people. But, you know, art has a way of reaching people sometimes the way, you know, facts and figures don't. Now, facts and figures are very important. You know, we live in a day and age where some people dismiss facts and the truth. I'm not saying that those things aren't important, but, you know, whether it's a song, whether it's dance, whether it's movies or television, sometimes they're just stories that hit us in the heart and they move us. And so with the Social Justice Summit, what we wanted to do was really try to bring together art and activism, whether it's presenting art that makes people feel certain ways, and we're doing that with a lot of the programming that we have in the week that's running up to our Social Justice Summit, with film, with dance, with spoken word, but also trying to show that art is a way to heal and a way to help keep people get past trauma. So we have individuals like Jaina Kayu, who runs Children of Peace Uganda, who's coming in from Uganda, and she works with children who were former child soldiers and using art and music and dance to transition them from just unspeakable trauma back to a sense of normalcy. We have people like Richard Cabral, an amazing actor who I've worked with, Emmy-nominated actor who's working on the Mayans right now. But he had spent his early years incarcerated for attempted murder around gangs and really looked at his life and said, look, this is either a life that is going to leave me in jail, it's potentially going to kill me, or I'm going to do something even more awful than just try to kill someone. But he's dedicated his life to change through art, through being an actor, not just for himself, but I've seen Richard work tirelessly with young men and women who are at risk and saying to them, look, if I can turn my life around, Anybody can do it. You can do it. And that's really amazing. Not the mistakes that people make, but how they dedicate themselves to changing not just their life, but many lives. So through this Social Justice Summit, you know, part of it, we want to honor people who are working tirelessly every day to make life more equitable for all of us, because social justice is not just for me, it's not just for you, it's for everyone. We want to highlight that. We want to highlight activists. And we really want to say to people that, you know, I think there are a lot of people right now, too many people, who are trying to change social justice into a pejorative, or say that it's just for one side of the aisle, or it's just something that those people are interested in, when again, it's really something for all of us. It affects all of us. All of us can unwittingly sometimes be involved in things that are inequitable. It's not just some of the more buzzier topics, but we talk about human trafficking. You know, I don't think most people would ever want to be involved in human trafficking, but it's the kind of thing that it can happen in front of us. It can happen in ways that are so insidious that we don't know.
That particular problem in Milwaukee is big. There's human trafficking happening literally under our noses.
Right.
And, you know, one of the kinds of things you're focusing on is criminal justice reform in this particular summit.
Right.
And that is, of course, a topic that's also so important here because there's so much work to do. Was that one of the reasons to focus on that? There's so many aspects of social justice, so many things to make right. How did you pick and choose which things you wanted to focus on?
You make such a good point. Look, you know, and that's part of the issue, too, is that we want to say to people, you know, social justice is not a narrow strata of things. Anytime, any space where there's inequality, there's a need for social justice. And with criminal justice reform, look, I think right now there is recognition that historically adjudication in the criminal justice system has been skewed. Certainly, over the last few decades, when you look at the 80s and the 90s, when criminal justice, it wasn't just about looking at circumstances and saying, look, we've got to apply some justice. But there was overreach and overapplication, particularly with young men of color. And you look right now in the political environment, you see on both sides of the aisle recognition that the criminal justice system, at least in the application of sentencing, is just, it's out of whack, and things need to be done. We cannot continue to incarcerate people at the rate that we incarcerate people, and it's not a cure-all. And it's certainly then, if you are going to lock up people and you feel like that is what is necessary, then on the other end, what are we doing to make sure that these individuals are rehabilitated and can live functional lives? Because that is, you know, if the prison is not about rehabilitation, if it's just about being punitive, then we're really not doing a very good job. So with criminal justice reform, there are a lot of pockets that need to be looked at. And certainly when I work with someone like Richard Cabral, who used art to change his life, who uses art to reach people, who uses the new status that he's found in his life, not just for himself to enjoy his life, but to really reach out to people and say, you know, look, the change is possible. Those were some of the things that were very important to us also, was looking at what artists do I know? What individuals in my network can I say to them, hey, if I'm going to do this social justice summit, can you come? Can you support some of these topics? And with human trafficking, Frida Pinto, an amazing actress who I've worked with, that's a topic that is she's very passionate about, and very passionate, as you say, saying to people, this is not something that happens in other countries and other underdeveloped areas. This can happen right in front of us. And if we're not all paying attention to it, then in some ways we are part of the problem.
You know, this reminds me of the very first conversation we had just as No Studios was opening, where we were talking about, you know, what you bring to Milwaukee by opening the studio, by using your own capital here. And I don't mean that monetarily, although I'm sure that's part
sure.
of it too. But you know, using that network that you've developed to bring it back to your hometown to try to make things better.
Well, that's certainly part of it. I mean, look, in any situation, almost in any circumstance, a little pixie dust, a little razzle dazzle, that always helps. And for me, just on a personal level, with No Studios day in and day out, you know, it's about artists and bringing artists in and having conversations in ways that we can support local talent in ways that we can bring recognition to Milwaukee and interest and highlight it. It's a great city. It's a wonderful city. Almost all the, you know, good quality values that I have in my life are things that I learned growing up in Milwaukee, certainly things imbued in me by my parents, but by their social network as well. But when we're talking about things that are, you know, difficult conversations, you know, even for people who think that they're open-minded and activated, you know, these conversations, sometimes they can take a toll on individuals. So I definitely want to try to make this, without watering down the subject matter, without saying, oh, these are frivolous and you should all just be, you know, drinking cocktails and things like that, saying, look, these are difficult topics. At the same time, I do want to make sure that this feels global, that this is not merely saying, hey, we're bringing these conversations to Milwaukee because Milwaukee is broke and it has so many problems that we have to bring people from outside to pay attention to them. We just want to say that Milwaukee is a city that has so much potential, that there's so many good things that I remember growing up. There's so many amazing individuals who we've met just in a year of having no studios being active, that we think with our partners like Marquette University, like the Milwaukee Bucks, like American Family Insurance, like those individuals who have chosen to support this summit, that it's important to us to bring people from around the world and really try to make Milwaukee a destination for great ideas, for change, for implementing those change, and for building an infrastructure so that the individuals who are activated 365 days a year, we can do everything we can to help support them and bring other individuals into their network and ensure that they can do the work that they want to do year round.
Is there a group here that you're hoping to reach that's outside of that artist and activist network? Are you hoping to reach politicians? Are you hoping to shine a light in a different way than is normally talked about when we're talking about these kinds of social justice issues?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that's one of the things that we're really doing. We're reaching out to all the politicians in southeastern Wisconsin, across the state, and making sure that they're invited. You know, if they show up, if they don't show up, you know, that's their choice. But we want to say to everybody, look, good ideas can come from anywhere. And if you're coming to the Social Justice Summit, you're automatically a partner. And you are invited to be part of these conversations. And I think that's very important. Look, none of us are always going to agree on all things all the time. I don't care where you sit on the aisle. And we shouldn't necessarily agree on all things all the time. We have different perspectives. We have different points of view. We're going to approach things differently. But I think what's important is to know that all people are invited to be part of that discussion. And if we can put ideas forward in ways that are energetic, that are respectful, if we can listen more than we preach, if we can be aware of everyone's perspective and take that into consideration as we move forward to try to implement these ideas, absolutely. So in that regard, we're agnostic. You know, personally, I may see things a particular way. There may be groups that I support more than others. But in terms of the Social Justice Summit, in terms of No Studio, actually, frankly, year-round, we want to be agnostic in that regard. We want to be open. We want to be a safe place for everyone who comes in. But absolutely, we're inviting anyone and everyone. And we hope that they'll show up. They'll be part of the conversation, if not this year, next year, if not next year, the year after. But in that regard, working towards solutions, if you're working towards solutions, if you can be respectful in that work, if you can be open-minded, then absolutely, we've got a seat at the table for you.
So what happens after November 16th? What are the next steps once the summit happens?
Well, we put together an advisory committee that is representing Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and frankly, all of America. And as I said earlier, we really want to build infrastructures so that it's not a once-a-year conversation. You know, there are people who are out there 365 working towards positive change. And more than just throwing money at the problems, more than just writing checkbooks, knowing that there's support, knowing that for people locally who may be looking for solutions, to be able to talk to people globally and find out what they did, what worked, what didn't work. And for people globally who are looking for outposts, who are looking for support, who are looking for ways to take the ideas that they have that have worked, but are looking for other areas to implement them, who are the people locally who have the the bandwidth, who already have the local infrastructure, who are looking for other people who can be supportive. How can we bring people together? How can we build these networks? How can we provide an infrastructure all year long? So part of what we want to do, again, is having an advisory council, having people who can year long be able to point people in the right direction. Again, whether it's locally, whether it's pointing people globally to local organizations or local organizations who are looking for outside help. You know, what can we do to maintain year round and make sure that the people who need help are getting help, and the people who have the energy and have the attitude that's right for social change, making sure that they're supported in any way that they're looking for support.
I have to ask, as we wrap this up, it's been a year since No Studios opened. Has it exceeded your expectations?
It's exceeded my expectations, but largely based on the communities coming together and really filling that space. One of the things that my sister Lisa, who really is running the studio day to day, and myself, we said to people, you know, we can build the physical space, we can support it with our networks. We can, as you said earlier, you know, we can support it financially as best we can, as long as we can. But it's really only going to work if people are active in this space, active as members, and even as members, being active in terms of what do you want to see? What kinds of events, what kinds of individuals, what kinds of talent do you want to see in No Studios? And we've had over the last year, you know, more than 400 events that are based on art, that are based on community. And the majority of them have been things that have been pitched by members and things that they've wanted to do, and just us looking at it and saying, look, how can we be helpful? And for us, as long as those events are essentially revenue neutral, we've tried to go out of our way to do everything we can support, everything we can do to make sure we can make those events happen. So it's been, in my opinion, it's been a huge success, but it's been a success in terms of the members, the membership, in terms of the way that it's been able to cross-pollinate and bring people together. And I say every time that I'm there and hosting an event or part of an event, and I say this with pride, I ask people to really look around the room and look at the demographics and how mixed they are. Young, old, black, white, Hispanic, individuals who may not be identifiable in ways that they're not part of the prevailing culture, but definitely have something to say and something to contribute and part of the fabric of Milwaukee. So it's just been very gratifying to see the way that people have embraced that space, things that we've done outside of No Studios, the dance fest we had at Sherman Phoenix, when we brought Alvin Alien and we had dancers, dance groups from all across southeastern Wisconsin, dance groups that you wouldn't normally see on the same bill, but when they were performing together, they touched everyone equally. Those are the kinds of things that make me most proud. But again, could not do it without the activism, the energy of our members, big and small. You know, we have corporate members now that are part of No Studios. Just so many people who are buying into what we want to do in southeastern Wisconsin.
Well, John Ridley, I want to wish you the best of luck in the summit and all future endeavors, and I look forward to catching up with you again. Let's not make it a whole year before we talk to each other again.
Absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate it so much.
Film director and Milwaukee native John Ridley is the founder of No Studios. The organization is celebrating its first year with a two-day summit on how art can inform social justice. The summit will take place at No Studios this Friday and at Marquette University on Saturday. Ridley spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and there's a link to more information about the summit at WUWM.com. If you're heading over to the summit, you might want to set aside an hour to stop by the Milwaukee Public Library's main branch first to see a photographic exhibit there called My Heart Is Not Blind. We'll learn more about it when Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Just past the front desk of the Milwaukee Public Library's Central Branch on West Wisconsin Avenue, there's a hallway you have to walk through to get to the stacks. Through the end of November, that hallway will be lined with a series of striking black and white photographic portraits. Called My Heart Is Not Blind, the exhibition is made up of photographs, a book, and audio recordings by Texas photographer Michael Nye. The exhibition was brought to Milwaukee by Wisconsin's Vision Forward, a nonprofit group that works with people who have experienced vision loss. Lake Effect's Bonnie North met Nye at the Central Branch to see the photographs and learn more about them. Nye says while he's been working on this show for the past 7 years, he really started thinking about it almost 3 decades ago.
I was in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, the capital. I was on an Arts America tour and had an exhibit at the capital. And the curator said, Michael, would you take a group of international blind students around and talk about your photographs? I didn't think much about it. And I will never forget, Bonnie, their attention, their resolute gaze. This was like a whisper could travel forever. And I just have never talked to a group of people that listened so intently and with purpose. And all of a sudden, they start asking questions. Why are you a photographer? What do these photographs mean? What's beautiful that's non-visual? How does anyone, blind or sighted, understand the world outside themselves? I mean, just really questions about what do you do in your life? What do you know? What does it mean to be human? What can you expect from the future? Those kinds of deep philosophical questions. And I remember that night, I just stayed up all night writing in my journal just about the nature of perception, how deep it is, how mysterious it is. So I did other projects. I spent 4.5 years interviewing people with mental illness. I spent 4.5 years interviewing people that are hungry around the country. Those exhibits have traveled extensively. But I came back to this one because I wanted the conversations. And I spent 7 years on this project. And I spent 2 to 4 to 5 days with each person. So they're deep, substantive, intimate conversations about their lives and about their altered perception.
Were all of them blind their entire lives, or was there a mix?
Well, I think that's one of the confusing aspects with the public. There's no experience the same. Some people are born blind. Some people are blind at 6, 19, 80. There are people that go blind in a second, like a car bomb or hit by a train. They're in this exhibit, shot in the face. Or others, long-term, retinitis pigmentosa, rod and cone dystrophy, choroideremia, where it's gradual, sometimes 5 years, 20 years, it's a gradual loss of sight. And then blindness is different the first year than it is the 7th year or the 20th year or the 60th year. And it's different if you have support, if you have family that understands, that you have education, that you have training, mobility. And then if you're visually impaired, it's incredibly complicated, near extreme, near blindness, and that's almost like living between two worlds, not really in the blind world, but not also in the sighted world. So, and then also whatever disease or injury they have is a different experience. So every story is personal and unique and uninvited.
Sight is it's the sense that I think most of us rely on the most. And I think the one losing, if we were thinking about losing a sense, that was the one that would scare us the most to lose. I've been so nearsighted all of my life that when I take my glasses off, it's like an impressionist painting. So I know what it's like not to see well, but I'm not visually impaired to the extent of that I can't drive or anything like that. But I think it's one of those things. And here we are, we're talking in the medium of radio, which is all about hearing. And there are times when you hear better, of course, when you close your eyes. And so that's one of the things that fascinated me about this whole project and the fact that it was happening in a library.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a library. It makes me think about this man by the name of Jacques Lusseron. He was French, and he was blind at 8, and he was a resistant fighter and one of the leaders, blind leader. And he said something which is very revelatory about this whole situation. He said, as much as we need our eyesight and how important it is for our evolution and the survival, there's a cost to everything in life. And the cost of eyesight is the detriment of our other senses. That's true. That's really true. And I think the public when they think of blindness, they think of darkness, blackness. And they imagine, well, if I went blind, I couldn't do anything that I'm doing now. I couldn't do the work I'm doing now. But what they don't understand, the calculus they never understand, it's so hard to say this, is that adaptation. What a powerful thing human beings can do. It's not just learning differently. Your brain can rewire itself to favor non-visual thinking and orientation. It's like another language. It's like learning Chinese. One day you wake up and you start dreaming. And the individuals that I have met, many, that had sight and lost their sight, I'd say 90% wouldn't take their sight back if it was offered to them, because they've adapted and the brain's rewired itself. And that's one of the things that the public doesn't get. It's not helplessness. It's not akin to death. It's not being buried alive. It's not a life of misery. It's not the end of the world. It shouldn't define you. But with the right education, with the right training, with the right skills, with the right resources, with the right opportunities and the right attitude, the right motivation, you can do anything being blind after you've adapted. At first, it's horrible and terrible, and you can imagine, but people adapt. And they adapt to their situation. It's amazing. It's such an interesting conversation.
In the 30 years that you've been thinking about this project and working with this, has it helped you see better yourself or differently?
I have probably every week for the last at least 6 years have blindfolded myself, maybe 20 minutes once a week. Just to experience listening better. It's nothing like blindness. Of course not. And I haven't adapted. But just to listen, it's amazing what you hear when you don't see. It's like your brain all of a sudden is in control saying, okay, what's going on here? And you start listening different. And you hear, you know, footsteps. And you hear car motors and the water being turned on in the next room. And you hear voices somewhere. And you hear yourself breathing. And touch is different, not just with your fingertips, but with your whole body. Also, I found out that almost everyone that's been blind long-term has developed echolocation. It's kind of a sonar. It's not amazing. It's very common, and that is sound bouncing off things. It's like an anatomy of sound, or a tapestry, or a fingerprint. You can tell when you're by a building. You can tell when there's a parked car coming up, or a tree, or an open room, or how high the ceiling is.
Because the air changes.
The air changes, the sound changes, the distance you are to an object changes. Some people are better than others, but some people don't even know they do it. But it's something that we all have the ability to do if we paid attention to it.
As you've put this exhibit together, and this is not the first place it's been, right? I mean, this, it's traveling around the country. What has been the reaction of the people that you photographed and with whom you spoke? How do they perceive what this exhibit is?
Well, I was a little insecure. I mean, I'm not blind. Why would I do a project saying something about their lives? And so I've tried to be like an extra in a movie, or be kind of invisible in some ways. And so I worked with every single person, played their audio, sent them the there's a book which is different than the audio, because you can edit audio, you edit audio different than you do text. And so worked really carefully and asked everyone, does this represent our conversation? Does this have a fidelity to, you know, what we talked about? And I think this exhibit is unique because I didn't have an agenda. No one asked me to do it. It was wanting to have conversations, and it's their voice. It's their experience. A young man, 25 years old, working for Exxon, electrician, going home at 11 o'clock at night and gets hit by a train, and it drags him down, and he wakes up in the hospital and he's blind. I think he was really different than almost anyone I met, because he said, okay, I've got three children, what can I do? I've got to do something with my life. And he starts getting mobility training, because you have to. How do you read? How do you write? How do you thing, you know. And so he started repairing cars in the middle of the night. People would take his car because he knew how to do it. He was a car mechanic. And so people would drive their car in the middle of the night. He'd take off, you know, all kinds of parts and repair them. And his wife, he said, still took out a flashlight. Even knowing that he was blind, she still would take out a flashlight. It has changed me. You asked me about seeing. You know, photographs are made in the present, but they're always about the past. And they're inherently ambiguous. I mean, that's the nature of photographs, is that it's susceptible to many, many interpretations or meaning. And there's an aesthetic to art, how light and darkness can come together and be incredibly beautiful in some ways. But there's many things that are beautiful that are non-visual. Just the tone of a voice, a handshake, the way people treat you. You know, on and on and on. They're, you know, it's surely not limited to the visual world.
What are you hoping that the people who have vision, who see this exhibit, who come to the library, and the way it's set up is you walk through it to get to the main area, so you can't help but interact with it in some way. What do you hope that they get from it?
Well, it opened at the Witte Museum in San Antonio. It's a really large, beautiful museum, and they had 25,000 to 30,000 people that went through the exhibit during the 3 months it was there. And they had a panel of individuals that were blind in the exhibit that talked. They had seniors and juniors in high school, 850 that came and had talks and research and went in the exhibit. And they had different lectures from people. But, you know, stories are windows into a larger life than our own. They are. And sometimes they can liberate us. They can remove the boundaries between ourselves and others. You can find out things. I mean, you both of us are readers. We went to libraries as children, and you find other people that have lived. You find mentors that you never knew. And, you know, I really have loved the quote from E.O. Wilson, one of my heroes. He's a biologist, philosopher, sociologist. And he said, I love this quote. I went to a lecture at Trinity University, and he said, "We're drowning in information. At the same time, we're starving for wisdom. Information's easy, wisdom takes time." That's true. And it takes time to listen, it takes time to tell a story. And I think this exhibit, not me, but the individual speaking, it is thick in wisdom. It's dripping in wisdom. There are, you know, very profound things that are said. And it's almost like the dialectical process. If you're with someone and you talk for 5 hours over 3 days or 7 hours, things just emerge that surprise you. And I think that's a nice thing about deep conversation.
And so you're hoping that people have that deep conversation with this exhibit?
Well, I think the discrimination against people that are blind is horrible. It's just pernicious. It's not intentional, but it is really a misconception. Can you imagine being blind? I ought to read Katie's really interesting thing from Katie Kim, who's in the exhibit, but she looks like a mermaid. I met her in Honolulu. And she went blind over 2 days, and she went to the Ho'o Center for the Blind in Honolulu. And that word in Hawaii means to make things right. I love that word. And so she met a man there that just went blind too. He was a deep sea fisherman. He's also in the exhibit. He was out 250 miles in the Pacific Ocean and had double retina detachments and went blind. And he almost committed, you know, he locked himself in a room and tried to get into fights and hit stone walls. But they both adapted. And now their entrepreneurs have 131 people working for them in food services and have a condo right there at Waikiki at Diamond Head overlooking the ocean. They swim every single day. This exhibit's about our shared humanity and our shared fragility. I think we all share both of those sense of qualities in our lives. And it's about adaptation, about perception, about understanding. So I hope people listen, and I hope they have a deeper understanding about the lives of others.
Michael Nye, I want to thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us on this very oral medium that we're talking on, and I so appreciate your time.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Photographer Michael Nye created the My Heart is Not Blind exhibition, sponsored by Wisconsin's Vision Forward Association. Nye spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. The photographs and audio recordings are on the main floor of the Central Branch of the Milwaukee Public Library through the end of November. You can see some of Nye's photos at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about some of Wisconsin's most legendary creatures with the author of Midwestern Strange. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Many of us have been here before. You're driving along a backcountry road and you see something strange. Maybe it's a shadowy figure in the distance or an eerie light in the night sky. Perhaps you feel uneasy, but you ignore it and you drive away. But perhaps you stay and watch. Suddenly, that shadowy creature comes into sight as a half-man, half-wolf beast. The eerie light in the night sky reveals a flying saucer descending toward Earth. And what do you do when the saucer opens up to reveal three small men who hand you a stack of pancakes before flying away? These are just a couple of the situations that allegedly happened to people featured in a new book titled Midwestern Strange: Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. The book's author, B.J. Hollers, is a professor at UW-Eau Claire, and he'll be in Milwaukee for an event at Boswell Book Company this Thursday. He joins me by Skype to talk about the book. B.J. Hollers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think there's a lot of stigma about the people who believe in these kinds of things, which you get into in the book. In fact, you call it a monster martyrdom.
I do. That's a great observation. I'm glad you brought that up, Joy, because the more I talked to folks, the more I really realized just how much they were putting themselves out there, you know, just by talking to me at all. And so I think it's true. A lot of times when people say they saw something, the next thing that other folks often say to them is, well, where's your tinfoil cap, you know? But the reality is a recent survey showed that 54% of Americans believe in extraterrestrial life in the universe and similar kind of strange phenomena are in some instances on par with that. And so there's more folks than we might think who are at least interested or open to believing in strange phenomena. But indeed, oftentimes there's a hesitancy to admit it out loud or in public.
Well, and you describe a number of different stories. Now, there aren't monster martyrs per se in each of the stories, but a few of the first ones that you talk about, there certainly are. And one who comes to mind immediately is Gail Harris.
Absolutely. Gail Harris. Just to give you a bit of background on that story, in 1949, there was an alleged giant turtle spotted in a lake in Cheribusco, Indiana. So this happened to be about 15 miles from my hometown of Fort Wayne, Indiana. So I really grew up with this story. But I learned a lot about it when I went back and visited and talked to locals. And sort of the main figure in this story, aside from the alleged huge turtle itself, is a guy named Gail Harris, who was the farmer and property owner who was alleged to have seen this turtle in his lake. And as a result of believing what he'd seen, and by the way, it was a sighting that was shared by many other folks, and, you know, thousands of people descended upon this small town, including major media outlets, he never was able to prove its existence, and it really damaged his reputation. And eventually, he had to leave his own small town. He had to leave his farm, not as a direct connection to the turtle sighting, I don't think, but certainly as a part of kind of being ostracized in some ways in his own hometown.
Well, what was crazy about that story is the turtle in a lot of ways kind of put that town on the map. And yet, because it was a small town, he was really ostracized as a result of it.
It is such an ironic thing because he became named the Citizen of the Year for the local paper in Cheribusco. But at the same time, you're right, they kind of drove him out of town in some ways. So on one hand, this town still benefits dramatically as a result of this alleged turtle. On the other hand, Harris himself never quite got his reputation back. So it's a complicated situation.
You know, when it comes to these kinds of stories, there are people who believe that the folks who see these things are crazy. And then there are those who say, well, they're just making it up. They just want publicity. But something inside of the turtle story and something that you look for kind of in each of these stories as you're researching them is evidence. For the turtle, it was the 300-foot net that he'd created to try to trap this turtle.
Absolutely. You know, one of the most difficult parts about writing this book was to kind of come up with definitive proof of anything. You know, if we had definitive proof of Bigfoot, we'd be having a very different conversation right now. But it's really hard to kind of find anything in interviews or the written record or tangible proof of any of these encounters that I talk about. But the turtle story is unique in that I was able to find this 300-foot net that was allegedly used to capture the turtle. Allegedly, Oscar the Turtle broke free of this net, but I would have never found the net to begin with where had I not had a conversation with some of the old timers in town who remembered distinctly that this net was apparently in a horse trough in the basement of the town's funeral home. So I went over there, I knocked on the door of the funeral home. The funeral home director was very kind. We went down there together, and sure enough, we found the net just where we were told it would be. So it doesn't prove the existence of the turtle per se, but I think it really does reaffirm the importance of this story.
A lot of the stories that you chose to talk about are actually right here in Wisconsin. One of them is from a town near where I grew up, and I knew the road that it was named after, although I had never actually heard this story, the Beast of Bray Road.
Ah, yes, it's a good Wisconsin one. In 1989, a woman named Lori Andreese was driving home from her job late at night, and she saw what she believed to be this bipedal wolf kind of on the side of the road eating roadkill. And so this was one sighting, but it was hardly the end of this. There have been dozens and dozens of sightings since. This story has gone on for well over 20 years now, and it's just such a curious tale. I mean, I think people love the idea of werewolves and these sorts of things. And no one's saying the Beast of Bray Road is a werewolf, but certainly, this idea even of a wolf-like creature running around on two legs in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, was really of great interest to folks, and that story has persisted for some time.
Yeah, there were a lot of sightings, apparently, since the 1980s. I'll say, as somebody who grew up maybe 15, 20-minute drive from Elkhorn, I never heard this story, and yet it seems like it was really dominating their newspaper for a bit.
It really did. But here's a kind of an interesting contrast to the Cherubusco turtle story in some ways. While the folks in Cherubusco really embraced their strange, so to speak, and really kind of tried to turn their big turtle into big business, in Elkhorn, you won't hear a lot about the Beast of Bray Road these days. Certainly, there's no major, you know, markers for it. Whereas if you visit Cherubusco, you'll find a turtle in every street corner. And so when I talk to folks in these smaller towns, I often kind of tell that story. You know, these towns that really embrace their strange, the benefit culturally and economically. Admittedly, it's a little trickier with a bipedal wolf. I think people can get behind big turtles a little easier. But yeah, I think a lot of towns have really found a way to turn their strange into a benefit for their town.
Yeah, the town that did that, it seems, the most is the home of the Mothman.
Right. In Point Pleasant, West Virginia, home of the Mothman, this kind of humanoid-like flying creature that's been seen since 1968, they've really done a great job of kind of marketing their monster. And there's, of course, a Mothman festival every year in September, and, you know, hundreds of people descend upon this small town in West Virginia, and there's a museum there and all kinds of things. I guess another place that does a fantastic job of kind of marketing their monster right here in Wisconsin is the Hodag in Rhinelander. So if you've ever driven to Rhinelander, there's a good chance you have seen a giant 30-foot Hodag-like creature right outside their visitor center.
The Hodag is certainly a Wisconsin legend. For people who may not actually know the story of the Hodag, can you explain that?
Absolutely. And, you know, I had never heard of the Hodag myself prior to my entrance into the state as well. But the short version is in 1893, a guy named Gene Shepherd was really trying to find a way to kind of market this small lumbering town, to try to get people to get off the train in Rhinelander and to stick around for a little while. So he dreamed up this creature. It's been described in all kinds of ways, part lizard, part dragon, part elephant, you name it. It's all kinds of things. And it became big news again. You know, it was in the newspaper and they kind of perpetuated this myth, became a part of the Oneida County Fair, this attempt to kind of see this creature. And so people would get off the trains and they'd go to Gene Shepherd's house and they'd knock on his door. And he had this whole elaborate plan where his children would kind of hide out in the back of the barn and they'd make all kinds of noises. And then Gene Shepherd would go to the back of the barn and he'd come out and he would change his wardrobe into this tattered suit coat that he had back there just for the purposes of allegedly having an encounter with the Hodag. And then he'd tell folks, oh, I'm so sorry, the Hodag is simply too dangerous to be seen today. And so the people would always leave disappointed. And yet they'd always come back. So it really kind of served its purpose and helped in many ways to put Rhinelander on the map.
Well, that's an example of somebody who really did create this hoax to try to get people in. And yet there are a number of stories. I mean, we just talked about some, Oscar the Turtle being an obvious example, but also a number of the Martian stories where people really believe in these encounters that they had. The one in Eagle River, Wisconsin, really stuck out to me.
Absolutely. And me too. Basically, the short version there is that in April of 1961, a man named Joe Simonton was washing his dishes in the kitchen sink and alleged to have seen a UFO land in his backyard in Eagle River. He described the Martians or the aliens as looking like, quote unquote, Italians. I'm not quite sure what to make of that, but apparently they came out of the ship. They handed him a vessel, which he took to mean they needed water. So he filled that vessel with water. He gave it to them. And then in exchange, they offered him, I believe it was 4 space pancakes. These are pancake-like cookies, and he ate one. He did not like the taste, and that's not even the strange part of the story. The story gets stranger still because the United States Air Force got involved. They confiscated some of these quote-unquote space pancakes, took them to the Food and Drug Administration, who finally ruled, and this is one of my favorite lines in the whole book, that the pancakes were of, quote, terrestrial origin. So it looked like all the ingredients were actually from right here on Earth. And so people would say, well, maybe they just sourced their produce locally. So there was all kinds of back and forth on that story.
But he did have pancakes.
He did have physical pancakes that he then handed off to the Air Force. I've seen pictures of him holding these pancakes. So these pancakes came from somewhere, though admittedly, I believe he did say he made himself pancakes just the night before for dinner. So who can say for sure?
Well, and some of the stories did have physical evidence. Another one that sticks out inside of the kind of Martian stories, because to be honest, the moment you got into Martians, I went, okay, well, this is where everyone's going to become pretty crazy. And the initial story of pancakes, I feel like, confirmed that. But the Val Johnson incident was pretty bizarre.
It's extremely bizarre. A short version there is that in 1979, a sheriff's deputy by the name of Val Johnson was near Oslo, Minnesota, and he saw a strange light in the sky. This light proceeded to hit the windshield of his police cruiser. It then went through the windshield without breaking the glass, left some burn marks on his skin. And the strangest part of all for me was that there was something like 14 lost minutes, both on his wristwatch as well as the police cruiser's clock. And so when I spoke with Val Johnson, he was very clear. He was not saying it was in any way extraterrestrial. He said trying to decide what it was is well above his pay grade. But here is a guy who has highly trained observational skills as a police officer, a guy who has physical damage on his body as a result of it. And that's the reason why it was often been labeled as a top 10 UFO sighting. There's a lot of tangible evidence left behind.
Well, and the idea that he really doesn't want to go too far into trying to figure out what it is was interesting, especially when you think of the idea that, oh, well, these people are hoaxers. This guy doesn't really seem to want to analyze it too much.
That's exactly right. And that's what made me trust him more. In fact, there were a lot of folks I reached out to. Some folks were very excited to talk to me. And frankly, I was more hesitant to believe those folks in many ways than the people who are a little more hesitant to talk to me. And Val Johnson hasn't talked to folks about this for decades. You know, it was just a bit of stroke of good luck that allowed me to have a conversation with him at all on this topic. And so he hadn't spoken about it, again, for decades. But I think we were able to kind of build up enough trust in each other. And he realized I was not in the business of throwing anyone under the bus. I was very careful throughout this whole process to make sure that I respected people's viewpoints. You know, I recognized they were taking a risk just to go on the record with me. And so the least I could do is to let them have their say in a way that what I hope would be respectfully done.
Well, the book is in many ways about taking risks. And it doesn't seem like you really give an opinion
either way on most of the stories. You posit a number of possible explanations, like the Beast of Bray Road, possibly a wolf-dog hybrid of sorts, possibly just a wolf, the Mothman, possibly a crane. But you don't give an opinion either way.
I really tried not to, you know, because I felt like I simply am not an expert on any of these topics. There are folks who have given decades of their lives to study here. And, you know, I'm trying to do the best I can in a year. But I really did try to take an Occam's razor approach as well. You know, what is the most likely outcome here? In a lot of instances, there are likely outcomes. But what I learned, too, is that there are some things which we simply don't understand. Some can be chalked up to confirmation bias, pattern-seeking parts of our brain, all kinds of kind of psychological elements to this. But again, sometimes you see UFOs on radar scope prints from highly trained military personnel, and none of them can explain it. And you got to think twice on those moments.
Well, and one of the stories that you bring up, which is actually just a short blurb inside of another story, but it's about, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, the coelacanth?
I believe that's pretty close as I can get.
It was an interesting story to include because it was an example of somebody going out on a limb saying, I don't think it's, you know, the easy explanation, and finding something pretty remarkable.
Absolutely. This is a giant fish that was believed to be extinct. It was found washed ashore one day, and one of the major scientists at the time kind of brushed it off as a large, I think, rock cod or some kind of enormous fish. But in fact, that this woman held firm to what she believed it to be, and she was absolutely right, you know, and had someone not put their neck out a little bit and said, look, I think we need to take a second look here. We might never have known that this creature had managed to exist for hundreds and thousands of years longer than we thought it had. And that's just another example of people who said the hard thing, you know. And we have to keep in mind, too, that a lot of these creatures, or a lot of creatures generally, seem pretty strange before we were able to give them a genus and a species, you know. So even if something like commonplace, like a rhinoceros or a giraffe, when they were first seen, seemed pretty strange to folks. And it's amazing how many species are still out there that are being discovered daily or being recategorized. And so there's a lot of strange stuff out there, but it becomes less strange when we kind of bring science into the mix.
What do you think these stories and the way that they're perceived culturally, perhaps, what do you think they say about us?
That's a great question. And I think that's sort of the biggest takeaway for me. You know, at the end of my readings, I always say, you know, we are who we are. and that's good. And we ought to embrace it, because perhaps the best thing we have as humans is our ability to believe in wonder and to look beyond preconceived notions and really test our own critical thinking skills to believe there might be more out there than we can see and feel and hear every day. For me, one of the motivations of this book was just being sort of dispirited by the fact of how quick we are to dismiss anything that just doesn't seem like it fits easily into our wheelhouse of knowledge, you know. And I really credit scientists and open-minded folks from all fields for looking beyond the easy explanations to look for the harder ones too.
Yeah. Well, BJ Hollers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, thank you so much, Joy. It's been a pleasure.
BJ Hollers is a professor at UW Eau Claire and the author of Midwestern Strange: Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. I spoke with him by Skype before his event in Milwaukee this Thursday at Boswell Book Company. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.